The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
With Donald Trump now heading back to the White House, what will his next term mean for U.S. policy, which affects us all around the world? The two significant ongoing wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East and climate concerns are two issues that could see significant policy change, and the impact, therefore, could be significant across the globe. Joining me now is Professor Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Now, let's talk about Ukraine, first of all. He said he could end the war in 24 hours.
That would mean a direct link with Putin and a sort of tacit acceptance that Trump will ensure that Ukraine does do a deal on the control of land. Whether that is possible, I think, is a different matter. Obviously, what you say rhetorically at a time of an election is one thing. What is possible later on is different. I think there's another factor which people are tending to forget, and that is while basically Trump is aversive to foreign wars, the military-industrial complexes are not. And Ukraine has been an absolute marvel for them because of the sheer number of weapons that have been used, that have been sold. And I mean, the United States arms manufacturers have been digging in billions of dollars worth of money going into this. And I think actually there will be resistance very much behind the scenes, but using all the lobby tactics to ensure that the war does continue in some way.
We presume the Democrats would favor continuing to support President Zelensky in his efforts. And if there are Republicans who that the arms manufacturers have the ear of, that it would not be plain sailing for Trump to just suddenly say no more aid for Ukraine.
I don't think it would be, frankly. And one tends to underestimate the power of many of the big lobbies. Now, one I'd acknowledge, probably the most important and most powerful lobby in the United States, is the combined oil, gas and coal lobby. I think the arms lobby comes a fairly close second. So I think there are very powerful interests there, and it has been immensely profitable. One has to face that. So all I'm saying is that don't assume that Trump won't come under pressure from within his own political circles, particularly Republican circles, to see this continue as a kind of a stalemate. Mm. Whether that succeeds, I very much do not know, and I rather doubt in some ways. But I think it'll be tried, and tried intensely.
Now, when you look at the other major war in which the U.S. has an interest, that of Israel on Gaza and on Lebanon, I presume the same arguments would apply from the arms manufacturers, but less resistance from Trump.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right there. And I think in many ways, we are going to see pretty big changes there. Trump has made it clear to Netanyahu, according to what I think are reliable press reports, that he would want to see an end to the war in Gaza and in Lebanon before he's inaugurated. In other words, essentially, Netanyahu's people have to get their act together and bring things to a close fairly soon. That implies that he would be willing to see them take much tougher action. And what now seems to be happening in Gaza, for example, is literally the clearing of all Palestinians from the northern third of the territory. That would probably speed up. And then I think, Netanyahu would have to accept that Trump would be quite happy to see a military occupation of some sort of the rest of Gaza continue. As far as the West Bank and Lebanon are concerned, that's very different. Deals are always possible in Lebanon, and that will depend partly really on Iranian actions in terms of their influence on Hezbollah. As far as the West Bank is concerned, I think the settler community and what I think one can reasonably call the far right elements in Israeli society that are so strong in support of Netanyahu will be giving something of a free rein. And the real question here is whether that extends to annexation of land. In other words, formal incorporation of large sections of territory into Israel itself in a political sense. And remember that Trump did accept this in the case of the Golan Heights during his first term.
But does Israel have any ambitions to annex any part of Lebanon? Certainly Gaza, there are many who'd love to take all of Gaza, to give a kind of a territorial integrity to the state of Israel. You know, when you look at Gaza and the way it's just it is a strip that would logically, geographically belong to Israel, but does not.
I think the point there is, as far as Gaza is concerned, the problem is 2.3 million Palestinians. And essentially what the far right in Israel wants to do is to see them leave. Basically, where they go, who knows, but certainly not in Israel and not in the West Bank. In other words, there is a desire to alter the population balance as a whole. Remember that as of now, if you take the whole of Israel, non-Jews are in a slight majority in the total. You know, there are about 7 million or so Jews, and there are about 7.1 million non-Jews. And I think they would very much like to see the situation where the balance alters much more in favor of the Jewish community. And to some extent, I think you see the settler behavior in the West Bank akin to that. It's to make life more and more difficult for Palestinians who've been in their own homes for many generations in the West Bank, as well, of course, of refugees, and to see them sort of almost move voluntarily and just emigrate out. And one has to remember that, you know, if the total number of Palestinians is of the order of 7 million, that's within Israel. There are at least 7 million in the surrounding state and across the wider world. So essentially, the total Palestinian community is something like 14 million worldwide. So that, I think, figures. But essentially, as far as Trump is concerned, he, I believe, would give the Israelis more freedom, more free rein to do what they want to do. In the short term, that is disastrous for the Palestinians. In the longer term, it means there's going to be years of bitter resentment. And one could really argue that, in fact, Israel is not going to end up more secure even.
What about Iran? I mean, and the development of a nuclear program in Iran. Were Iran to develop deliverable nuclear weapons, I mean, you would hope that it would lead to some sort of a standoff whereby Israel would know if it attacked Iran, there would be mutually assured destruction of the two countries. And that applies on both sides of the argument. So are they likely to get the nod from Trump to have a preemptive strike against those nuclear facilities?
I think that is much more likely than under Biden. But the problem is that any preemptive strike can probably only do fairly limited damage because the Iranians have been prepared for this for a long time. The things are buried very deep underground and very difficult to get at, even with the most modern American-made earth-penetrating warheads. And the problem is that any kind of attack on Iran, directed particularly at the nuclear, directly at the nuclear facilities, would certainly encourage virtually any Iranian regime in Tehran to go as quickly as possible for some sort of nuclear capability. The further problem is that if Iran at some stage in the next 2 or 3 years was to test fire even a crude nuclear device, that is a long way from deliverable nuclear weapons. And I think that would basically herald a period of repeated Israeli strikes. Now, whether the the Trump administration in a couple of years' time would want that is another matter. For many states in the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia, they would welcome that kind of limiting of Iran. But it goes to huge uncertainty. And, you know, you can't predict the outcome of that sort of dangerous circumstance.
Now, what about NATO and Trump's threat to withdraw from NATO? In other words, to devote the U.S. military resources not in Europe, but maybe towards the Chinese and protecting Taiwan, admittedly, at a price he's talked about charging them, if you like, for their insurance policy.
That, I think, is very uncertain. Obviously, Trump will come under pressure from many European sources to renege on what he has said and to maintain contact with NATO. I don't think you can even predict where that will go. I mean, as far as what Trump's people are saying is they want to diminish the involvement with NATO and see NATO look after itself more. But these are very uncertain times. And I mean, it could change very quickly in terms of American opinion. So, yes, it looks that way. And it looks like there may be more of a tilt to the Pacific, which will affect the Chinese very much and make them very concerned. But at the same time, that's one area where I think prediction is extremely difficult.
Now, he on climate, he is a climate change denier. In spite of all the hurricanes that are rattling down Hurricane Alley already this season, and they will continue for some time. Cuba blacked out at the moment, and Cuba so close to the United States is another example of the ferocity of the hurricane season. That's likely to have an impact, what he does, globally.
It will, and I think this is where we could see the real uncertainty. Trump is convinced that climate change is basically a sham. It's a plot of some sort, and he has very powerful lobbies behind him. I mentioned the oil, gas and coal lobby at the start, and very strong vested interest to keep the oil flowing. And I think that is one area where he will be insistent on doing it. Against that, one has to remember that within the United States, there are two factors which we do forget. And one of those is many states are going it alone. California, most notably, many other states do see the danger and don't accept what Trump is doing. Also, many areas of renewable energy are now cheaper to use than oil or gas. And you see this extraordinary phenomenon of wind farms springing up on the Texas plains, you know, the oil-rich state. And this is where economic matters are starting to move against the oil industry globally. And this is why you see that in many ways in Britain, we are seeing some change here and a greater move under Labour, one of the few changes under Labour, I think, so far, to a greener economy. And some of the new wind plants in the North Sea are going to be incredibly efficient. Now, in a sense, that undercuts what the oil and gas companies are about in the longer term, maybe not in the short term. But, you know, when it's a matter of profitability, it's not so easy for Trump to insist that climate breakdown is not happening if the answer to it is actually cheaper than the existing forms of energy use. That, I think, is one thing which we have to see. Also, it is so blatantly obvious that we're now into an era of climate breakdown. Now, the extraordinary thing is, you know, you had the American election on Tuesday, two or three previous days, these appalling floods in Valencia.
Yeah.
And I think that the villages, you know, visions of cars parked two or three high because of the power of the water. And what is it? A year's worth of rain falling in the space of about 24 hours. These are very different times. Yeah. And I understand just in the last hour, the Copernicus Center has said that this year is virtually certain to be the warmest year on record, and it will exceed the 1.5 degrees thing. So things are changing very quickly there, and I'm not sure that Trump will actually be able to hold out King Canute style on this issue.
Can you understand why the mass manufacturer in the United States of electric vehicles, Elon Musk, is in his corner when he wants to stick with the gas guzzlers?
I really don't know, but it does raise the very important question of some very powerful, extremely rich individual interests that are so active in American politics. And that, I think, is another subject, obviously. But money seems to have been fed into the campaigns at a late stage, principally Trump's, at an extraordinary rate.
Musk's,
Musk is a good example,
The final example or question about Trump is, in 2 years' time, after the midterms, I mean, he's already a lame duck in the sense that he has no political future. Now, maybe he sees his sons as following in his footsteps, and certainly J.D. Vance would have ambitions to be the candidate in 4 years' time. What will that mean for Trump when, you know, no one needs necessarily to defer to him or kowtow to him because of that lame duck nature of this term?
Well, he could always try to change the Constitution and go back to longer terms. You know, more than 2 4-year terms. Don't rule that out, but I think that's unlikely. Yes, he will be something of a lame duck. And remember, also in 2 years' time, you have the mid-sessionals. And the one thing he doesn't yet have, as far as I'm aware, is proper control of the House. And that is still up for grabs. And that would make life more difficult for him because it would mean a stronger level of opposition at the congressional level. But the midterms may be pretty crucial. The other thing, of course, to remember is that if Trump does not last the 4 years, you know, health-wise, then you would be getting a J.D. Vance presidency. And that is something which I think many people would worry more even than what we got with Trump.
And presumably J.D. Vance would then finish out the Trump term and have two terms available to him.
I think that's right. Yeah. I'm not sure, but I think that is right.
Because I'm thinking of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who took over from John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, right, of course,
And had a term and then dropped out of the bid
for
a second
term. Yes. So that's something, you know, 12 years ahead of Trump and Vance. Yes, that's something interesting to think about with a strong whiskey, I think.
Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.